This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Last week, we profiled an article in The New Yorker by the writer Andrew Solomon. And in it, he explored how this idea, this image of a family, is expanding. People are evolving. That's the word President Obama used to describe how he came around on same-sex marriage. And Solomon points out how, in the same way the legalization of interracial marriage helped to moderate racism in this country, gay marriage has increased the acceptance of same-sex couples. So he wanted to see if that allowance, that assent, will continue to evolve to include other types of relationships and parenting arrangements. Solomon profiles polygamous families and polyamorous families. And as we talked about last week, he found examples of both here in Utah. The article publicly revealed for the first time that State Senator Derek Kitchen, for a brief period, about 3 years, was in a polyamorous relationship. Now, remember, Kitchen was part of an incredibly important lawsuit challenging Utah's ban on same-sex marriage. He wanted to marry his partner, so he sued. His name is on the lawsuit. But as Kitchen told us this week, he didn't reveal the polyamorous part of the relationship because it's complicated. And as Andrew Solomon puts it in his article, Derek Kitchen was in hiding about his sexuality even when he was the most visible gay person in Utah.
Back in 2013, when I filed Kitchen versus Herbert in federal court seeking the right to marry, it was seen as something that was not going to happen, especially in a state like Utah. You know, it was a long shot. And when we finally received the good news from Judge Robert Shelby on the 20th of December that year, it was eye-opening to us and everybody else. All of a sudden, you had law folks from all over the country, people who had been working on marriage and the legalization of marriage for LGBTQ people, flying into Utah to meet the plaintiffs and to help strategize around the case, because it seemed at the time Utah's case was the first one to legalize same-sex marriage in federal court. It seemed like Utah might be the case to legalize it for the whole country. So there was a great deal of pressure from legal scholars and advocates and folks who had been in this space working toward full equality for decades. And one thing that became clear is that the narrative was so important right now. We were battling a case, you know, in the court for full recognition, but equally important was the battle for the public mind, you know, for normalization and to be accepted broadly, not only the culture here in Utah, but nationwide. And there's an enormous amount of pressure on me to toe the line and to be as digestible a gay character as possible. Of course, that didn't preclude me from bringing my authentic self to the table, but it did mean that I couldn't deviate too far from what was considered traditional, you know, two-person relationship, house with a picket fence, the idea of a family, moving forward in a professional environment, not wanting to rock the boat too much. There was a lot of pressure just to be quote unquote normal. I was also a young adult in my early 20s and, you know, experiencing life and moving forward, trying to find love, happiness, and build a life for myself, and figure out what it was that I, as an adult person, want. There was definitely some exploration going on at the time with myself and my partner and trying to discover what it was that was going to make us happy in the long run. The goal is happiness in all things. And I think, you know, in that we were, you know, exploring what that might look like for us as a couple. And so, yeah, we had been engaged in a polyamorous dynamic. And during the lawsuit, this became a part of me that must be kept quiet.
We reached out to Derek Kitchen after our conversation with Andrew Solomon because we wanted to hear more about Kitchen's views of family and monogamy and this second decision he had to make in his life about coming out.
My conversation with Andrew Solomon happened in May of 2020. And the context of the time is really important considering the whole world had sort of shut down due to the COVID-19 pandemic. A lot of disruption had taken place. We were in a space where we didn't know what was going to happen the next day. I think everybody felt that to some degree. And my headspace at the time was sort of a why not attitude. You know, there's no reason in a world where who knows what's happening, you know, the next day or the next week, what's coming our way in terms of the business climate or the public health situation. Why be shy? And so my attitude at the moment of the interview almost a year ago was, why not be transparent here? Yeah. And so, you know, I answered his questions with honesty and openness. And I felt like he did a great job revealing my story without, you know, putting all the details that I divulged to him, you know, in print. Mm-hmm. So I appreciate his journalism, of course, here. But yeah, I think the headspace that I found myself in then sort of shocked me a little bit when the article came out a few weeks back. But I also have to realize that that was where I was at the moment, and I'm going to own where I was at that moment and stand by my openness, and that's why I'm here today.
But why shocked? But in the sense that, oh, that's right, I revealed this thing to him in this moment, and you had, I'm not sure if you had forgotten necessarily, but maybe hadn't taken in exactly the import of what you were saying a year ago. Is that right?
Precisely.
Yeah. I wonder how you compare the experience of having to live your life as a gay man, you know, deciding whether to come out or how to come out publicly, fully live your true sense of identity, be authentic. How you compare that to revealing that you were part of a polyamorous relationship or that you have an even more complicated feeling about human sexuality? How do you compare those two?
That's a good question. You know, I really am so grateful that I am a member of the LGBTQ community. Obviously, coming out in childhood and dealing with the cultural issues at the time made it a really a large challenge, personal challenge for me, and something that at the time, you know, felt really daunting. But I think, you know, being a member of the LGBTQ community has allowed me to focus primarily on my own happiness and really live in my identity. I have to own my identity. And so I think that just the whole experience of coming out in my, you know, youth and defining myself sort of as an emotionally stable, secure person, gay person, and then also realizing that so much of the world is going to view my quote-unquote lifestyle as a gay man as immoral or unethical and something to be avoided, especially coming from a Mormon background, right? And so I think that that gave me a lot of courage just to be myself. And I think a lot of queer people experience this as well. And so when it came to the concept of, you know, diving into a relationship and crafting a family and a life with somebody or some buddies, I think that it was a matter of, again, my own personal stability, my own personal happiness that was driving all of this, not so much what the rest of the world would think. And so I don't know if that gets to the question enough, but that's I think that I draw those two together.
I hope this is an appropriate question. Do you think of wanting to be part of a polyamorous relationship as a kind of sexual orientation, or is it just one of the options that you think about as, you know, as a human being or as a gay man? Does that make sense?
I think it's important for me to be clear here that I never imagined or desired out of the gate a polyamorous relationship. It's just how a relationship with a primary partner evolved as we opened up. And so I think polyamory is something I'm willing to fight for me in case I desire it in the future, right? And anybody else, but also it doesn't preclude an option of a single partner, right? So I think it may be a lifestyle for some people. I wouldn't say so for me, because it's simply just a way of engaging in a dynamic with people. And so I suppose I wouldn't for myself, you know, categorize this as a lifestyle as much as I guess, you know, seeking again happiness and emotional stability. And I will say that, you know, here in the West, the Western world broadly, you know, we put a lot of pressure on our marriages. We expect our partners to make us happy at all moments, to meet all of our needs physically, emotionally, spiritually, and otherwise. And that's just a great deal of pressure to put on any one individual person. And so one thing that I had found after moving through a long-term relationship with a primary partner and then moving toward a polyamorous dynamic is a couple of different things. But the first one is that it acted as an enormous release valve for those pressures that build up in life. So a partner shouldn't have to meet, again, all of those emotional marks, because it's impossible for any one person to be able to do that. And it's quite unfair for me to expect that out of one person. And so having a second person that I also shared a great deal of intimacy and love with, who was able to sort of show up for me in ways that I wasn't, you know, getting my needs met, ended up creating a much healthier and happier dynamic, personally speaking. And so I think that that's a huge takeaway here. And then another thing that's, I think, to the challenges of a polyamorous dynamic is, you know, in a three-person dynamic, you actually have four relationships. You know, you have a relationship with in an individual relationship with each of the other people, plus there's a relationship among all three. So that, you know, that's four relationships that you've got to juggle. And so it's not that it's easier necessarily. In many ways, it can be harder. But I did find that I slowed down a lot in my, you know, emotional interactions with my partners. And I think that that allowed me to be a little bit more intentional about, you know, what I was saying, what I was doing, how I was communicating, what feelings I was bringing forward, and how we crafted a life together. And so, you know, it is a lifestyle for sure. And whether or not people, you know, engage in that lifestyle for a short period of time or the duration of their whole adult life, it, you know, it depends on what their circumstances demand. But it definitely is a lifestyle choice. While I would say homosexuality is sort of one of those things that you can't choose, you can have some choice around how you engage with people, right?
Yeah. Interesting that the article hasn't been out that long, and I'm wondering if people are taking note now. Like, what kind of reaction you're getting? I'm wondering, are you getting reaction from colleagues, and at what point you think there's going to be a sort of larger public reaction? I'm thinking about the word lifestyle, because lifestyle is one of those – just the term itself, it was one of those really fraught terms in the early fight against same-sex marriage and really against the idea of whether or not, you know, being gay was some sort of a choice, that it was a lifestyle. It's a pretty fraught word. And I'm just thinking about – now that there's another, as you say, a polyamorous dynamic that comes into play, if that, I just wonder what you're expecting and what kind of reaction you're going to get.
You know, I have received a fair amount of feedback from people all over. Here in Utah, not so much. I think because the whole idea of polygamy, which is a little bit different but sort of related, polygamy is so demystified here in Utah.
Right.
And so I haven't received a lot of, you know, there isn't a lot of people who are shocked or unfamiliar here. On the other hand, you know, I've got colleagues that work in other state legislatures and people that work in the activist community all over the country. And I've gotten a lot of just quick feedback from people that are saying things to the effect of, thank you for telling your story. I've known people like this before, or I've engaged in something like this before. And I appreciate you reducing the shame around this by being transparent about it and open. And And so I think that, you know, a lot of people, you know, we talk about how I was going through the gay marriage fight and sort of keeping this secret, right? Mm-hmm. And being cautious. I think a lot of people have engaged in open relationships to one degree or another and have felt a lot of shame or fear from society at large rejecting them or judging them. And so I think that the fact that this conversation is coming forward in the pages of The New Yorker and elsewhere in you know, public media, I think we're able to sort of talk about it in a productive way, in a way that maybe allows for a healthy dialogue, healthy discussion without this thick layer of shame or judgment. And so I think that there's a lot of gratitude out in the world for us just simply talking about it. You know, on the other hand, I have, you know, some friends that are engaging in platonic types of, you know, love situations, maybe raising children together in three or four parent dynamics. And I think that, you know, while I'm talking about polyamory with, you know, love among three, there's a lot of people that are grateful that this conversation is alive because it sort of fits their lived experience as well. Mm-hmm. And so I think that, you know, it's about individual freedom. It's about liberty. It's about, you know, empowering people to be intentional about their family making. And again, I think that that intentional family is, again, a hallmark of the queer community.
In Andrew Solomon's article, there's this question that comes up, and it is, what if the fight for same-sex marriage had played out differently? At first, he mentions the argument was being made about the fact that a marriage certificate was this fictitious legal distinction. But eventually the gay rights movement fought for marriage. They said, no, let's go with marriage as this institution. And for whatever reason, maybe they just thought it was going to be more acceptable to make that case. But some see that as a missed opportunity, that it was a chance to say, do we really need this legal document of marriage? How are you thinking about all of this now?
That's a really interesting question. And, you know, you got to keep in mind that this, you know, in the article, he speaks to the fact that there was a gay couple in New York and one partner died of AIDS and, you know, was at risk of losing their apartment.
Yeah.
Because the authorities didn't see it as a true family.
Right.
And in fact, the courts said, nah, the marriage document is a fictitious document. And what we consider family should be what exists in the real world. How is this, you know, in practice working out? And that was a real opportunity, I think, maybe for the gay rights movement to grab that and craft a different type of legal narrative to win protection in our country. But, you know, so many things went into this. You know, we had just lost a generation of gay men primarily to HIV. And so that set back our movement, you know, many could argue. And then, you know, as we move forward, you know, in 2004 with John Kerry versus George Bush and, you know, the Christian right really making it about guns, God, and gays. And that's when Utah, for instance, passed Amendment 3, which, you know, outlawed gay marriage in our Constitution. And so I think just the general thrust of the narrative over, you know, the following couple decades after that original, you know, decision from the New York court sort of just mandated that it's marriage that we fight around, because everybody, by the way, understands what marriage is. Everybody understands that, you know, at least in traditional terms, marriage is a union between two people that love each other and craft a family and, you know, buy a house and do all the things, right? And and so for us to make our case of equality under the law, marriage was an easy way for us to communicate that, right? And so I don't regret that it, you know, was marriage, but I do realize that marriage as an institution is, if not dying, it's definitely, it has sort of like crumbled and then it's being recreated in many ways. And so it's more complicated today than even, you know, a couple of years back in 2013 when the Kitchen case was moving forward.
You know, it's interesting when you talk about whether, and this is something you told Andrew Solomon, that marriage will fade away. But I wonder what you think about the idea of monogamy. Esther Perel also says in the Andrew Solomon article that monogamy, traditional monogamy, is, as she put it, on the wane. She says many social norms just don't fit human nature. And for most of history, monogamy was one person for life. So what do you think about the idea of monogamy? Because that does seem different in a lot of people's way of thinking from marriage. Okay, so marriage is a document, but monogamy is about loyalty. It's about connection, and I don't know. Just what do you think? Is there a big distinction, and how are you thinking about the idea of monogamy as it plays forward?
I really love the way Esther Perel puts it, because she said monogamy used to mean one person for life. Now monogamy means one person at a time.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I didn't finish the sentence, but that's right. Yes.
And I think that, you know, that's very true, at least in my experience. You know, my parents had been through divorces and things of that nature. And it's a very common occurrence, especially among millennials and Gen Z, growing up with parents from or split households. Right. And mm-hmm. So, you know, monogamy, I think at the end of the day, what I hope comes out of all of this is that each individual person is empowered to strike a healthy relationship with their partner or partners that meets their own needs. And only you as an individual can decide what that means for you. And so I think monogamy is something that is, you know, it's sort of unique in the animal world. You know, humans are one of the few that actually engage in monogamy. And it's built up with a lot of social and cultural pressure over the millennia. And it's definitely breaking down in that sense. But I think I'm happy to see people that engage in lifelong monogamy with a partner, because that means, my hope at least, it means that they're empowered to make that decision on their own and not doing it out of a sense of obligation. Same for polyamory, right? As long as we have consenting adults deciding for themselves what works for them, then I support that.
Let me ask you finally, it's a similar question to what I asked Andrew Solomon last week. How far do you think this is going to go, this extension of legal rights to people who have, you know, who have broader ideas of what a family means? Do you think there's going to be some sort of ruling, some sort of test? Will it just be that now that the really, in some ways, the ice that's been really broken through same-sex marriage ruling now, that we'll just start to work these through, not in the courts, but in our lives in more cultural ways? How do you think this is going to play out in the next few years?
It's hard to say. I will, you know, but for me, I'm not interested in personally waging into, you know, a legal battle on this front. But, yeah. You know, again, relationships are changing. And if you look at the big picture, we really need to make sure that we're creating a world that is supportive of the individual and all different types of lifestyles. And so, you know, people are oftentimes nowadays choosing to not partner up, to not get married, to stay single, for instance, right? They do not have access to many of the legal and financial benefits that come with getting that marriage certificate. And so I would say that, you know, if anything changes down the road, my guess is that we'll stop incentivizing marriage with tax benefits, perhaps, or certain, you know, you know, benefits that just come with that, you know, fictitious piece of paper, as the New York judge put it a couple decades back. And so, you know, I don't know exactly what's going to come of it, but I will be paying very close attention as this, you know, conversation evolves. And, you know, it moves. It's not about me or any one individual person. You know, I think the story of the Dargers and other polygamists is really interesting. You know, I grew up in South Jordan, and I grew up with, you know, kids in my school that were children of polygamous families. And it was a little bit odd, but it became normal real quick, right? And so I think that just watching this evolve, culturally speaking, is going to be very fascinating. And I'm guessing that it'll be, you know, non-traditional families of all types and of all stripes are going to be embraced a little bit more broadly than they ever have. And I think that that's a good thing for our very diverse country.
Senator Derek Kitchen, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
That's State Senator Derek Kitchen. You can find our conversation with Andrew Solomon on our website. And, of course, you can subscribe to Radio West wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.